The following sermon was preached at Selma Community Church, a church in Jefferson City that exists to build communities of transformed disciples who live for the glory of God by connecting people to Christ and community. For more information, you can find it at www.somajc.org.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to break this up a little bit and do things just a little bit differently than what I did in the first service, so just bear with me. As I said in the first service, this is a very humbling experience to be standing up here. It's something that Kevin said last week, and it's something that we've shared amongst ourselves. It is an awesome responsibility that we don't take lightly. And again, all the utmost respect for Brother John that does this week in and week out, two times a week. Kevin and I have had probably 3 or 4 weeks to get ready for the one we get to do every 3 or 4 months. Having said all that, let's get right into our scripture for today. Turn with me, if you will, Genesis 40, and we're going to begin reading in verse 1. If you're using one of the Pew Bibles, it's on page 33. When you get there, if you would, just stand in honor of the reading of God's word. Verse 1 says, "Sometime after this, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt and his baker committed an offense against their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. And he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard appointed Joseph to be with them, and he attended them. They continued for some time in custody. And one night they both dreamed, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, each his own dream, and each dream with its own interpretation. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody in his master's house, 'Why are your faces so downcast today?' They said to him, 'We have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them.' And Joseph said to them, 'Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me.'" Most gracious Heavenly Father, Lord, we just thank you for another opportunity to be in your house this morning. Lord, we just pray that everything that we do here will be honoring to you and will be a blessing to you. Lord, I pray now that the troubles of the week, that you'll push those aside and let us just concentrate fully on what you would have for us to learn this morning. And it's in your name I pray these things. Amen. Yeah, be seated. You don't have to stand up. I'm going to vary a little bit from where we started this morning. This story about Joseph has always been a very interesting story to me. From the very first time that I heard it, I found it intriguing that Joseph would be thrown into a pit by his own brothers, his own family, that he would be traded away as a slave, end up in some country so far away, just him by himself. I've often wondered how that might feel, having been that way. I have a Joseph story myself. I didn't spend any time in prison, so don't get all excited about that. I wasn't thrown in the bottom of a pit or slave traded or anything either. But I think it parallels that story of Joseph, and that's why I find this story so intriguing, I guess. For those of you that don't know, many of you do, I was raised in Texas. I spent, 18 years getting an education, graduated from high school there, and then spent the next 4.5 years, I guess, in college, getting a degree that I didn't use when I got out of college. That's a whole other story. But I found myself in a position of going to work at a newspaper, the only newspaper in town. It's a pretty big newspaper, served some 30-something counties around where we were at. And at the time, it was very stable. I had a wife. Our oldest was on scene at the time. Our second was coming. So it was a job, and it was a job that would pay the bills and support the family. So I readily jumped into it. Spent probably the next, 14 years being groomed by the circulation director to take over his position when he left. And then probably about 14 years into it, he retired sort of unexpectedly with a medical condition. So myself and everybody in the department was just sort of expecting I would ascend to, quote, the throne, if you will. But that didn't happen. The publisher at the time had interviewed with some of our sister newspapers, and they brought in an assistant circulation director to become our circulation director. I can remember as vividly as it was this morning, the day when he came to interview just within our department. There was no publisher, no other department heads or anything. It was just him and us, and we talked to him. I can remember thinking, this is probably the cockiest, most arrogant person I have ever run into in my life. And as he told us before he walked out the door, he says, I'm really not here to interview for this position. I'm here to interview you guys to see if I want this position. And I wasn't the only one in the department that kind of held that thought of this is the most arrogant, cocky guy we've ever met. Well, a couple of weeks later, he becomes our boss. As you can guess, there's probably some hesitation, some I wouldn't call them ill feelings, but just some weirdness about him coming on board, not only from myself, but from others. We just didn't really know how to take him, what to expect from him. As it turned out, over the course of the next 2 or 3 years, God kind of showed me why. This cocky, arrogant man that came in and basically took my job turned out to be one of my best friends, one of the strongest Christians I believe I've ever met in my entire life. He taught me more probably in that next 2 or 3 years, not only about the position of circulation director, but about how to be a Christian in the working world. So you see, I wasn't ready for that position, and I think God knew that. So let's fast forward another 2 or 3 years. The newspaper that I worked for was sold to a corporation, and as is usual practice, when a corporation buys out something, they usually come in and take away most of the department heads and put their own people in place because obviously they have their way of doing things, and that's exactly what happened in this position. Fortunately for my boss, he moved to another department just prior to all of this happening, so his position was saved, but they did move a new person into the circulation director. So for the second time in like 3 years, I had my third boss. Not so much a blow this time because I wasn't really excited about moving up to that next level because I see what happens to those people at that level. I kind of wanted to keep a job. So things rocked along. Not so good a start. And I can tell you that this next guy did not turn out to be one of my best friends, and he was not one of the strongest Christians that I had ever met. He was given a charge when he came in to reduce expenses and increase revenue. Well, he immediately started playing with the books and the numbers and things like that, much to the detriment of the department as a whole, but it made him look good. And that's really all, as it turns out, that he was concerned about. So his praises were being sung down the hall in all the top-level executive meetings, but he was killing the department. The men and women, the boys and girls that get up of the morning and deliver the newspapers, he was taking so much stuff away from them that it was very difficult for them to continue doing that. That's a way of living for those people. So it was very hard for them to continue making a living with the things that he had taken away to reduce the expenses and at the same time increase his revenue. So kind of seeing the writing on the wall, I had sent off a resume to a newspaper in Arizona. Like I say, I'd been working now for 16 years, and this newspaper in Arizona was a family-owned newspaper, and it was no bigger. Let me give you a little background first. Our city was broken up into like seven districts, and a district is nothing more than just a geographical layout of the town. So I would have been responsible for a district, which means I'm responsible for hiring and training all the people that deliver the newspapers. I'm responsible for making sure that they get their collections done and pay for their bills and things like that. So at the time that I had applied for this position with this newspaper in Arizona, the entire circulation of that newspaper out there was only slightly larger than the one district that I had worked in and that I had grown up in. So I felt very confident that I could handle that position. Was hoping against all hopes that I would get an immediate call and we could go and I could rid myself of this nightmare that's going on. But that didn't happen. Once again, back in the pit. Boss left town for 2 or 3 days. I don't remember exactly what the purpose of the trip was. But as you can imagine, I had a lot of friends at the newspaper. Been there for 15 years. Get along fairly well with most everybody anyway. One of the people from the advertising department caught me in the hall and said, "Can we talk?" I said, "Sure, you know, what's up?" "Well, your boss has put your job in the ad in the newspaper. He's looking to hire somebody." More little background about the newspaper business. We have what we call blind boxes. And for employers, I guess, that don't want to be bombarded with just a lot of people walking into their business and handing over resumes and doing those kinds of things, they can run an ad in the newspaper and just have all the resumes sent to, quote, a blind box. It's just a post office box that the newspaper has, and all those resumes will come there. We'll take the ads, and then we'll give those to whatever employer it is. So it kind of removes them from the spotlight. People don't really know who they're applying for, but they know what the qualifications and things are. I looked at the ad, and sure enough, I couldn't have written a better ad of what I was doing. So needless to say, I was quite shocked, upset, mad, hurt, shocked, upset, mad for 2 or 3 days until he got back on that Monday. And that wears on a person. Not knowing, number one, whether I was going to have a job the next day or not. Number two, that it had been done so behind my back, I guess. Not that I was necessarily owed anything, but I don't treat people like that, and I don't deal with people like that, so I kind of expect to be dealt the same way. But again, as I say all that stuff, I want you to hear the I in all that, okay? I was the one that was hurt. Forgetting that God's probably got a purpose in this for some reason. So I don't really have a reason to be hurt or upset, other than the fact that I wasn't looking to God for my answers. So I walked into my boss's office. We had a meeting first thing, generally once a week with him. And after all the others had left, I just looked at him and told him what I had found. And he says, "Well, number one, I'm disappointed that you found out." And I said, "Well, you know, these people are my friends." I said, "So it wasn't like they were trying to do anything against you. They were just trying to be a friend to me. So don't take it out on any of them." And he said, "Number two, yes, I am looking to replace you." And I said, "Well, that's really all I wanted to hear." I said, "You didn't need to do all of this stuff." I said, "We're both big boys here. This is the real world. I understand." I said, "I don't necessarily like that I'm losing my job, but it is what it is, and I understand that." He said, "Okay, I've got to leave tomorrow. I'm going away for a conference." And he said, "I just wish while I'm gone that you wouldn't say anything about this to anybody." I said, "Okay, you've got my word." I'm sure he was not wanting me to cause an uprising while he was out and then come back to some mess. But when he came back, it was, Monday or Tuesday of the next week, and he called me into his office, and he says, have a seat. So I went in, sat down, and he looks me in the eye, and he says, I can't believe it. I said, well, what can you not believe? He said, nobody knows you're going away. I said, but you asked me not to tell anybody, so I didn't. He said, well, I'm just not used to dealing with people like that. I was expecting to come back and have all these people all bent out of shape and upset. And I said, I gave you my word, and my word means a lot to me. So anyway, long story short, he arranged to have a severance package put together for me, and I finished out that week, that month. I mean, we were very close to the end of it. Said my goodbyes, went back to the house, and this ebb and flow starts over again. I've got a family I've got to support. What am I going to do now? Because I'm 16, 17 years into a position here. What do I do next? So, like I say, I grew up around town, so I knew quite a few people. So I started putting out resumes and started going on interviews. And you hear the same thing. We know you can do the job, but we think you're overqualified. We know you can do the job, but you're too qualified. Whether I was or I wasn't, I was really getting old. I wanted the job. I needed the job. It was time to be doing something. And then one day, just out of the blue, I get a phone call, and it's from that newspaper in Arizona. Hadn't heard anything. This has been probably 9 months now since I sent that resume off. He says, we've got a position open, the circulation director's position. Are you still interested? And I said, absolutely, I am still interested. When can you come? I said, how about yesterday? And he says, okay, make the arrangements, come. We made the arrangements and went out there. Checked into the hotel. I cannot remember if Princess Diana had just died or if she was getting married, but I know she was the only thing that was on TV to watch while I was out there. So I was anxious to get to the interview the next day because I can only understand so much of the royal stuff before it kind of gets old. So anyway, I went, called the publisher the next morning. He came by the hotel, picked me up, took me on a trip around the town, showing me the town. We ended up, I think it was a Denny's, had breakfast. We talked some more about some different things that he wanted to know about me, so everything was out on the table. And before breakfast was over, he asked me if I would be interested in taking the job. So he had offered me the position. And I told him that I was very much interested, but this was a big move. I've been out of the county that I grew up in not too many times, but I played ball, so I was exposed to the big city life, okay? I made a trip through Dallas going to somewhere where we played one time. So this is a move like halfway across the world to me. And it's not just me. If it had just been me, not such a big deal. But this is uprooting Michelle, who's now getting very accustomed to her job and moving up the ladder. She's in child support. We have three kids. One was a junior in high school. Big move for a junior. We had one that was in her last year of junior high. Again, a big move. And then our son was a sophomore. And we come from a very small school. Kids went to a very small school. So moving out there, it wasn't a big town, but this high school was huge. Looked more like a prison. It had 8-foot chain link fences around it. It had a guard station in the front of it. You couldn't even get into the place if you didn't have a kid in the back seat with you or some card or something that showed you were supposed to get in. So as it turned out, a very rough school for the kids. But not knowing any of that stuff at the time, I accepted the position. We made an agreement as to when I would be there. So I showed up, and then I was going to come back like a month later and get Michelle and the kids and move everything out to Arizona. Sunday before I was supposed to work on Monday, I'd gone to church. Being in the hotel and not knowing where a whole lot of stuff was, I just kind of gone down the phone book and said, Baptist Church, and that's right on this same street, so surely I can find it. That's how I located the first church that I went to out there. So I showed up, hadn't been there 3 minutes, and a lady comes up to me and introduces herself and says hi. And I mean, same thing we do here. We greet the new people coming in. They know the new faces. And she just asked me what brought me to town or what brought me there. And I told her, well, I'm starting a new job tomorrow. And she says, well, what do you do for a living? And I said, well, I'm going to work for the newspaper. Her eyes just lit up because she worked for the newspaper. And she goes, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I'll be working in the circulation department. And the biggest shock came on her face because she says, I work in the circulation department. She says, you're not coming to do the newspaper racks, are you? And I said, no, because that's what I do. So she kind of slid on off to the side. That was the end of the introductions and how are yous. So I thought, that's kind of strange. Next day, I show up at work for the first day, go into the publisher, the owner's office. He's waiting on me, so he takes me, and we walk around to the different departments, the last one being the circulation department. We walk into this little office, and there's two people sitting there. The lady that I had met the day before, sitting off to the right, and a gentleman sitting behind the desk. And he introduces me. He says, this is your replacement. This is Ricky. He's going to be our new circulation director. Before I had taken the position, when I was back in Texas and I called him to affirm that I was going to do that, his words were, okay, I am going to let the current guy know. Well, he did that morning when he was introducing me to him. I'm shocked. I have never been in a position like this before. I don't even know what to do. So just out of, I don't know, courtesy, I don't know what you want to call it, I just stuck my hand out. The guy obviously didn't shake my hand, didn't hurt my feelings, none at all. I don't know what I'd have done sitting behind that desk. So we leave, and you can imagine what's going on in the circulation department at this point in time. We walk back over to his office, and he hollers at the general manager, and he says, come on, we need to go fire, and that's his words, the circulation director. He says, you just stay here until we get back. And I'm thinking in my head, if I had a way to get out of here right now, I would leave. So, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes, an eternity passed, and they came back. And he says, I can't believe that. And he tells the general manager, he says, when we were over there the first time, he wouldn't even shake Ricky's hand. And I'm thinking, oh, man, what have I gotten myself into here? So he takes me back over to the circulation department and introduces me again. Of course, everybody is in here now. And you can imagine the air in the room, if you will. They don't know me from Adam. They probably think I'm part of this whole shenanigans. I mean, they're angry. And quite frankly, I'm kind of angry as well. This guy that was the circulation director had come from Lubbock, Texas, which was, I don't know, 4 or 5 miles, 4 or 5 hours down the road from where I grew up. I was very familiar with the newspaper. Two of his district managers had left that same newspaper in Texas and came out there with him. So I just called them all together and I said, I want each of you to know that I'm so sorry for what just happened. I don't do business that way. I would never treat any of you like that. and I had no knowledge this was going on. I was told this was going to be taken care of a month ago. I can understand your feelings, and I want to go around the room, and I just want each of you to just tell me a little bit about yourself, just introduce you to me, and feel free to say whatever's on your mind. So we did. We started around the room, and as you can expect, there weren't very kind remarks, and they weren't necessarily directed at me. I'm there for 30 minutes. There's not a trust, a bond built up between us yet. The two guys from Lubbock that were out there as district managers said, I can tell you, I don't know if we'll be here the end of the day or even tomorrow morning. A couple of ladies in the office there voicing pretty much the same thing. And I told them, I said, I can understand, and if you're not, there'll be no hard feelings. Don't feel like you're walking out on me. I said, as a matter of fact, I've got some praying to do about whether I'm going to be back here or not. So left that day, got back to the hotel room, called up some of my guys at church that I'd been going to church with and explained to them what was going on and said, hey, we got to pray. I don't know if I'm supposed to be here or not. I mean, I really felt like God was leading me here, or I wouldn't be here to start with. So we did, and talked to Michelle, told her what was going on, and she said, just, we'll do whatever you want to do. So going through all of that, I had decided that God wouldn't have brought me out there if he didn't have a purpose for some reason, so we decided to stay. So I did. The two guys stayed. There was only one lady in the office that left, but she was already accepting another position before I ever got there, so I didn't feel like that was on me so much. But things were kind of rough going in the beginning, as you could very well understand. But as they got to know me and I got to know them, things started picking up, much like Joseph in Potiphar's house. Things were looking up for him. Circulation was going up, and that's primarily my job as a circulation director, is to make sure things are going up. Bills are being paid. Sales are happening. I mean, things are really looking good. And then a new face shows up. This is probably, 8 months in, 9 months in, something like 9 months, pretty close to 9 months. And he was brought over to the circulation department and introduced as like the general manager over like circulation and advertising and things like this, because this newspaper was a daily newspaper in the town that we were in, but it was a weekly newspaper in a lot of the smaller towns around, much like the Tribune is here. Daily delivery here, but kind of a weekly or a biweekly in other places. As you could imagine, having been on that horse before, my ears are kind of perked up. I'm thinking something doesn't taste right here. And it didn't. Probably 2 weeks later, the two guys, district managers, that had told me a few months before, I don't know if we'll be here at the end of the day or not, came over to my house and told me that they had seen the new circulation guy, general manager at one of the restaurants they were eating at, and overheard him offering him a job as circulation director. And of course, I'm thinking, and I told him, I said, you know, thank you for looking out for me, and thank you for letting me know. I said, but please know this. Don't worry, because I'm not. God brought me here for a reason, and if that reason is done and he's ready to move me on, I'm good with that. And if it's not, and I take a lesser position here, I'm good with that. So whatever God's doing, you guys know I'm okay. You should be okay. So the opportunity presented itself in the next day or two for a face-to-face with this guy, and I just told him, I said, you know, I've been here before, and I said, I just want to know, I said, I don't want it eating at me anymore. I said, if you're replacing me with him, then just tell me. He says, that's what we're going to do. I said, okay, that's good enough. And he said, because I had a company car and everything, and that's what I was driving back and forth to work. He says, I'll take you home, or I'll follow you home. I'll take you home, I guess, because if he was following me home, he had to leave his car there. I'll take you home. That way I can get the car. And I said, that's good. And then I'll tell everybody tomorrow morning. Well, tomorrow morning didn't get around. I wasn't home 30 minutes, and I was already getting phone calls from the people at work. I mean, they saw us talking or something and knew something was up. So they were calling. They were coming over to the house saying how sorry they were, and on and on and on it went. And the same thing I was telling them. This is in God's hands now. I'm not concerned about this. And really, from the first time, I guess God had changed my heart enough that I was more relying on him than I was on me trying to beat down the doors and find a job. So even though I didn't have a job, had no clue what I was fixing to do, I'm okay with this. I truly am at peace with this. Went back in a couple of days later, and again, got at work. They had arranged another severance package. I've only been on the job for 9 months, and usually that doesn't happen until you've been there for a while at any job. So I'd gone back in to turn in keys and computers and cards and whatever else that I had that belonged to them. And there was a lady in HR. I walked in, and she was filling out the papers. She says, you know, I'm so sorry about what happened, and I just need you to sign this and this and this. And I did, and I was giving her all the stuff. And she says, I just cannot believe you're acting like this. I said, what do you mean? She says, well, you're okay with this. And I said, well, you know, I'm not telling you that I enjoy being fired from a job. I'm not telling you that any of that stuff. But I will tell you this. God brought me out here, and God will take me wherever I'm supposed to go the next time around. I knew she didn't go to church. Very few of them did. But God had given me an opportunity to witness to several people while I was there. And like Joseph, and certainly, please hear what I'm saying, I'm not putting myself on Joseph's level by no means at all. I couldn't, what does it say? I couldn't knock the dirt off of Joseph's sandals, okay? But like Joseph, my strength during that time was coming from God, because, again, I've got a family I've got to support. Michelle has just started a very high-paying job in Phoenix. So what are we going to do? Well, God opened the door for us to move to Missouri. God placed Michelle in a job with her sister here that was equal pay or better. So that burden was pretty much taken off. I stayed about 2 or 3 weeks longer to finish cleaning up the house and finishing out the rent, get the truck, get it all packed up, and we moved to Missouri. I had an opportunity then to go back to school. I got my second degree in computer science, which is the field that I'm in now. Went to work for that same company where Michelle was working at, which eventually led to a job with IBM, which, I mean, we're just talking increase after increase after increase. And I mean, and that's good. That's a good thing. I was learning. I was moving up. We searched around town for churches to go to. We finally ended up at Concord. And from Concord to here. So God has a purpose in all of this. It's just a matter of, are you willing to wait on God? I could have bailed. Well, let's back up. I could have bailed in Texas. I could have taken other jobs, maybe, if they'd given it to me. And no, there's no telling where I would have gone. I could have bailed in Arizona the very first day, but through godly counsel from some of my friends at church, through praying, through Michelle, we decided to stick it out there. So that ends up with me being here, with Michelle being here, with our family being here. Is this my final destination and God's plan and all this? I don't know. But I can tell you, from looking beginning to end, God had a purpose in all the things that he brought me through. The letdown of not getting the circulation director's job, he showed me. I wasn't ready for that. He showed me how a Christian man can act in a non-Christian world in a position of authority. Invaluable when I got out to Arizona, because you can imagine how riled up those people were out there. Now, I could have taken, like the world, and fired half of them to make a point. I'm the boss now. Buckle down, and this is what we're going to do. Or I could have taken his Christian teaching, like he taught me, and applied it out there, and that's what I did. Not a soul went away, and they were just as loyal to me and worked just as hard, if not harder, than they'd ever done in their lives. So I had built those relationships by the blessings that God had given to me. And then God, for whatever reason, says, I'm done with you here. I need you in Missouri. I didn't even know where Missouri was. Missouri was a stopping place on our way every summer to go to Michelle's mom and dad's out in Illinois. The first rest stop in Joplin or the one in Springfield was always a stop. Going and coming back home. That's as much of Missouri as I ever knew. I'll take it back. We played, when I was playing college baseball, we played a team from Missouri early, like in February or March every year. Because, as I know now, you can't get outside in February or March playing baseball in Missouri unless you want to wade through the snow. So that's why they always went south to play ball. So I did have an experience with Missouri there. But it was in Texas. It wasn't here. So back to our story today. We've got three primary characters: Joseph, the cupbearer, and the chief baker. So first I want to look at how they all got in prison together. We find in chapter 37 a 17-year-old Joseph that's been thrown into a pit by his brothers, sold to some Ishmaelite traders, headed for Egypt for 20 shekels of silver. And then upon arrival in Egypt, these same traders sold him into slavery with Pharaoh. Pharaoh comes later. Potiphar is the captain of the guard, very high-ranking officer in Pharaoh's palace among his staff. Chapter 39, verse 2 tells us that the Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. Joseph enjoyed much success in Potiphar's house for some 8 to 10 years. He was in charge of everything in Potiphar's house and everything outside of Potiphar's house. That is until Potiphar's wife got tired of being rejected and threw up some false accusations against Joseph. And it was these same false accusations that lands Joseph in prison. And this is a prison where Potiphar, Joseph's old boss, placed him in charge of the prison. Now keep that in mind, because we'll come back and visit that in just a little bit. Genesis 39:23 says, the keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge, because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. So Joseph has come full circle now from his father Jacob's house as the favorite son to Potiphar's prison as the favorite prisoner. Let's look at the other two characters in our story, the chief cupbearer and the baker. What is a cupbearer? What are the responsibilities to Pharaoh? The job description for a cupbearer is fairly simple. He is to taste and drink all of the food or wine before Pharaoh tastes or eats it, just in case it was poison. This job would require someone who was courageous, obviously. You don't know what you're eating or drinking. Might be your last. Someone who was in touch with everything that was going on around the palace, because if there was some plot to kill Pharaoh by poisoning the food, you might want to know that as the cupbearer, because that might save your life. From Pharaoh's point of view, he would want somebody he could trust, someone who was loyal to him, even to the point of death. While this job was fairly simple in nature, it was a very important job on Pharaoh's staff. And what about the chief baker? What was his responsibilities? He was responsible for all the food that was prepared for the Pharaoh. He was in charge of not only himself and the food, but all of the cooks and people that put all that stuff together. While he didn't have any taste test, if you will, to endure, to find out if the food was poisoned or not, he was still a very trusted and very important part of Pharaoh's staff. Both of these guys, being around Pharaoh a lot, had the ear of Pharaoh, so they had an opportunity to speak to Pharaoh about different things and maybe some influence there. So as you can see, not just any old cook or any old baker would do for Pharaoh. Genesis 40, verse 2, and I'll read from the English Standard Version first. It says, "And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker." King James says that Pharaoh was wroth. This just means very angry against his two officers. And the Message Version of the Bible says that Pharaoh was furious with his two officers. Angry, wroth, very angry, furious. The Bible doesn't tell us for sure what landed these two in prison, but most of the commentaries that I read suggested that they were involved or knew of maybe a plot to kill Pharaoh, to poison him. Again, the Bible doesn't say. I don't know that we know for sure. It may be that Pharaoh woke up one morning in a bad mood, and these two guys were the first ones in line, and he says, "You two, out of here, off to prison with you." But whatever reason, physical reason, that they ended up in prison, we know one thing for sure, and that was God had made a divine appointment with these two to actually meet with Joseph in prison. So now we know how they ended up in prison. Let's take a look and see if we can understand or figure out just exactly what this divine appointment was supposed to be about. Verse 4 tells us that the captain of the guard, who we know now is Potiphar, appointed Joseph to attend the cupbearer and the baker, to serve them and to take care of them. Remember now, this is the same Potiphar that has thrown Joseph into prison based on the false accusations from his wife. The same Potiphar that has placed Joseph in a pretty high position within that prison. Again, all pretty strong indications that Pharaoh wasn't so sold that Joseph had done anything wrong with his wife, or else Joseph probably wouldn't be alive. One morning, as Joseph was tending to the cupbearer and the baker, he noticed that they were troubled and asked him what was wrong. They both told him that they'd had a dream and didn't understand what it meant. And to make matters worse, since they were in prison, they didn't have access to anybody that could interpret these dreams for them. In the Egyptian society, if you will, culture at that time, this dream interpretation was relegated to magicians or sorcerers that were part of Pharaoh's staff. So obviously they didn't have access to any of these people. So in verse 8, the latter part of verse 8, we find Joseph's response, and he says to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me." Very short, simple statement from Joseph to the cupbearer and to the chief baker that showed not only Joseph's faith in the Lord, but his acknowledgement of God's authority over everything, even dreams. Also a statement, because again, I point you back to the fact that current times, those interpretations were left up to sorcerers and magicians. Joseph pointing out that interpretations belong to God was sort of a slap in the face of those sorcerers and magicians and their little g gods responsible for these kinds of things, by saying that God, has authority over everything. So what's with Joseph and all this dream stuff? Back in first chapter 37, Joseph had a couple of dreams that he shared with his family and with his brothers, and we know how that ended up. Joseph in the bottom of a pit, on the back of camels, headed to Egypt, sold into slavery. So that didn't turn out real well. But the roles are reversed now. It's not Joseph having the dreams. That's the cupbearer and the baker. Joseph is now on the interpretation side of this. So read along with me, if you will, or follow along with me. Genesis 40, and we'll read verses 9 through 19. It says, "So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him, 'In my dream there was a vine before me, and on the vine there were three branches. As soon as it budded, its blossoms shot forth, and the cluster ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand.' Then Joseph said to him, 'This is its interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you shall place Pharaoh's cup in his hand as formerly when you were his cupbearer. Only remember me when it is well with you, and please do me the kindness to mention me to Pharaoh, and so get me out of this house, out of prison. For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I have done nothing that they should put me into the pit.' When the chief baker saw the interpretation was favorable, he said to Joseph, 'I also had a dream. There were 3 cake baskets on my head, and in the uppermost basket there were all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh. But the birds were eating it out of the basket on my head.' And Joseph answered and said, 'This is its interpretation. The 3 baskets are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat the flesh from you.'" So here we see that the chief cupbearer was the first up to share his dream with Joseph. And after hearing his dream, Joseph gave him the good news. The dream was pretty clear cut. The cupbearer was going to get his job back. Everything was going to be restored just like it was before. The chief baker, having heard the good news, couldn't hardly wait to tell Joseph his dream. Caution, careful what you ask for. Because the news for the baker wasn't quite as good. Joseph told the chief baker that in 3 days, Pharaoh was going to hang him on a pole, and the birds were going to eat his flesh. And I'm pretty sure that's not the news that the baker was expecting to hear. Just a few things I would like us to take note of in Joseph's interpretations. First and most importantly, as we already mentioned, Joseph made sure that the two of those guys knew where those interpretations were coming from. Not from him, but those interpretations belong to God. Just another sign of Joseph's integrity, his character. There's nobody around, just him and these two. He could have easily taken credit for those interpretations. Maybe enhanced his chances of getting out of prison a little quicker. But even at the detriment of getting released earlier or quicker, Joseph chose to remain faithful to God and gave him the credit for all of those interpretations. Secondly, he was not vague in his interpretations. I've never been to a psychic or any of these card readers or anything like that, but I can only imagine that they're probably not as direct and to the point as what Joseph was with the cupbearer and the baker. They would probably say something like, "The sun's going to come up tomorrow and you're going to get out of bed." Well, obviously the sun comes up every day and I get out of bed every day, so how could it go wrong? But for Joseph, he was very specific. He said 3 days, very specific time. Something was going to happen to the both of them. And it wasn't just something. He told one of them, "You're going to get your old position back," and he told the other one, "You're going to die." So very specific things in a very specific amount of time. Additionally, he was to the point with both of them. He didn't beat around the bush when he was delivering the good news to the cupbearer. And he was just as direct in sharing the bad news with the baker. Joseph was not afraid to boldly speak the truth that God had given him, whether it was good or bad. And lastly, we see that Joseph had asked the chief cupbearer to remember him when Pharaoh released him from prison. He wasn't whining or complaining about his plot in life. He simply stated the facts as they were. He had been stolen, it's the words that he had used, from his homeland. Didn't necessarily mention that it was his own brothers that stole him from his own homeland and sold him off somewhere. And he had also been put into prison for a crime that he didn't commit. And this brings us to our last four verses in the passage today. Follow along with me. Verse 20 says, "On the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants and lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among the servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his position, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." Everything had come to pass just as Joseph had told the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. 3 days had passed. Pharaoh sent for the both of them. He restored the cupbearer and hung the baker. But once again, Joseph is kind of left hanging out to dry, because the chief cupbearer had forgot all about him. So once again, Joseph's hopes had been dashed, and he finds himself still in prison. So what are the applications that we can draw from our passage today? I think the last time that I was up here, or maybe the first time, I don't remember for sure, I said something about the Old Testament was a foreshadowing of Jesus. For those of you that weren't here or don't remember, foreshadowing is just a big, long word that just means it points towards something or is an indication of something that's going to happen in the future. And I think our verses today are a very prime example of that. Let's look at Joseph first and pick out some things about him. He was the favorite in his father's house. Dad had even given him a special coat, many colors, that he didn't do for the other 11 brothers. He was the 11th of 12 sons born to Jacob. He was the firstborn son with his favorite beloved wife, Rachel. So his other brothers were born to Leah, who was actually his other wife, and Leah's maidservant and Rachel's maidservant. But he was the first to his wife, Rachel, who he loved the most. He was betrayed, Joseph was, by those close to him. His own brothers wanted to kill him, but settled for throwing him in a pit. They sold him into slavery for 20 shekels of silver. Joseph was falsely accused of crimes he didn't commit. He ended up in prison. He actually hung around with criminals. Not like he had much choice since he was in prison. But he did develop a relationship with them while he was there, at least a couple of them. Joseph shared good news as well as bad news with the cupbearer and the baker. Let's move on to Pharaoh and look. On his birthday, he sent for two officials that he had thrown into prison. One he redeemed by acquitting him of crimes he had been charged with, and the other he put to death. One spent the rest of his life in the presence of the king of Egypt, and the other was never going to set foot in the palace again. So how does all this point towards Jesus? I think some of this is fairly obvious with the parallels that can be drawn. Jesus was betrayed by those in his inner circle of disciples. Judas sold him out to the Jewish religious leaders for 30 pieces of silver. Peter, one of his most beloved disciples, betrayed him in the courtyard, denying he ever knew him. Not once, but three times. Jesus was most definitely falsely accused and condemned to die for crimes that he did not commit. Jesus hung around with those that some might consider less than desirable, murderers, thieves, prostitutes. That was who Jesus ran with during his ministry on earth. And the dreams themselves, three branches and vines, three cake baskets, all point towards the 3 days that Jesus was in the grave before he arose to conquer sin and death once and for all. One of these days, just like Pharaoh sent for the cupbearer and the baker, Jesus is coming back for us all. It won't necessarily be for his birthday, but it's going to be more of a day of reckoning for us. On that day, some, like the cupbearer, will be redeemed and will spend eternity in heaven with him. There's going to be others, on the other hand, though, that's going to suffer a similar fate, much like that of the chief baker. They're going to forever be separated from him. Most importantly, Joseph had a message for what was to come for the cupbearer and the baker. Jesus came into this sin-filled world with a message of redemption for every one of us. You're all familiar with one of the most well-known and probably one of the most memorized verses in the Bible, John 3:16. This is the English Standard Version, so if I kind of slide into the old King James, because that's what I grew up with, forgive me. But read with me if you will. It says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life." That is the gospel, folks. But and for so many years, I would stop right there. But the verses from 17 on through the end of the chapter are just as impactful and just as much a part of the gospel message as John 3:16. Verse 17 says, "For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only Son of God." Verse 19 says, "And this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God." Joseph's message to the cupbearer was of good news, and to the baker, not so good. The same is true with the gospel message of Jesus Christ. It is the true desire of Jesus that everyone be saved. Verse 17 said, "God didn't send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but he sent his Son to save the world." So that's Jesus' desire. That is his heart, to save the world. But, and he didn't just die for the Billy Grahams of the world. He died for all. Romans 3:23 says, "All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God." I got a pretty good education, and I can tell you for a fact, all is a whole bunch of people. It's everybody. And as I stated before, Jesus wants everyone to be saved. He also pointed out, though, that people love the darkness rather than the light because of their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light. And I'll tell you now, those people will forever be separated from that light and will spend an eternity in hell. So the gospel is good news and it's bad news. For those that accept, we're going to be there in heaven with them. And for those that don't, those people are going to forever be separated and spend an eternity in hell. People that know me know that I love sports a lot, baseball, football specifically. And one thing that increasingly bothers me is some of these post-game interviews with the stars or the heroes of the game after the game's over with. The reporter runs them down on the field and puts his arm around them and says things like, "Tell us about the winning play," or "Tell us what was going through your mind when that happened," and all this. And most of the time, you'll hear something back that goes probably not a far fetch from here. It says, "I was waiting all day for them to come my way. When they lined up in that formation, I knew they were coming right at me. I was watching the quarterback's eyes, and when the receiver made that cut to the outside, I jumped the route, and that was it. There was nothing between me and the goal line. I was for sure going to score that touchdown. Oh, and also, I want to thank God for giving me all this talent and letting me play with such good teammates." Really? And you want to thank God for your talents and your teammates? That's the sickening part to me. It's almost as if it is the politically correct thing to say during your interviews. When you sign your contract, somebody must tell you, okay, if you get interviewed in post-game, you got to mention God somewhere in there, okay? Even if it's just like an afterthought. I don't want to stand in judgment of these guys' relationship with the Lord at all, because I don't know. But they're sure not using what God has given them in the right way, in my opinion. Just last month, it was the second round of the NFL playoffs. I was sitting home. I think it was a Saturday afternoon. The Minnesota Vikings were playing the New Orleans Saints. The quarterback for the Vikings had a reputation of never being able to, quote, win the big one. Not only the big one, he hadn't won a playoff game ever. Kevin spoke last week about some guy named Patrick Mahomes, plays for the Chiefs. I'm telling you, Mahomes is much better quarterback than my quarterback is, but hang with me. The game was great, and the quarterback for the Vikings threw the winning touchdown in overtime, which made it even more exciting and all this stuff. So you can imagine what's going on after the game's over with. Of course, all the reporters are running towards the quarterback. All the players are around the field congratulating each other. And the reporter catches up with Kirk Cousins, and I'm thinking, oh, great, here we go again. Another one of these interviews with an athlete that wants to thank God for something. The reporter asked him how heavy the load was that he had been carrying around on his shoulders. He said, I know you have a deep faith. They usually say that when they're trying to cut them off and say, don't say anything about God. But it has to be very difficult to block out all the outside noise about not being able to win the big one. And then my ears kind of perked up when I heard Kirk Cousins' response. He said, I take comfort in God's sovereignty, no matter what happens on the football field. Like you said, my faith is important to me. It is the foundation of my life. And ultimately, that is where I gained my peace and my strength. Win or lose today, I knew God was still going to be on his throne, and I take comfort in that. What a message to the world. What a huge display of faith. It does my heart good when a true Christian athlete uses the platform that God has given them to stand up and publicly praise our Lord. We're almost done, but I want you to imagine with me, if you will, for a minute, how an interview with Joseph might have gone. Let's suppose that ESPN or Fox Sports was there at the prison. The chief cupbearer and the chief baker standing at the door with Joseph, and two of them are released from prison, and there stands Joseph. The reporter looks around, searches out Joseph, and says something to him like, Joseph, it's a pretty well-known fact by now that you haven't had a lot of breaks go your way recently. Kind of a roller coaster ride. Your brothers threw you into a pit, sold you off to some traveling merchants headed to Egypt. You arrive in Egypt and get sold again. Things kind of looked like they might be going good for you until Potter's wife had those accusations and landed you here in prison. Now the cupbearer and the baker are leaving, and here you are still in prison. How do you handle all this adversity? What keeps you going through it all? And just knowing Joseph's character, I can only imagine that his response would have gone something like this. The Lord has always been with me. He has guided my steps all the way from the pit my brothers threw me in to the slave traders they sold me to. He was with me when I first arrived in Egypt and was sold to Potiphar. And now as I stand here in prison, I've learned through it all, no matter what happens to me, God will still be on his throne. And because of that, I am content and have learned to wait on the Lord. That brings us to our soul tattoo for today. Are you willing to wait for God? Are you like Joseph? Are you willing to wait for God no matter your plot in life? Are you willing to be faithful in it all, the good times and the bad? Psalms 27:14 tells us, wait for the Lord, be strong, and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord. Will you be able to acknowledge that the gospel is God's message and be able to deliver that even when some don't want to hear it? Will you, like Joseph did with the chief baker, be able to tell the truth in love? Remember, the chief baker's news wasn't real good. Will you be a shining Christian witness when times are going really, really good, and then throw some huge pity parties for yourself when the times come your way? Or are you willing to endure even through those hard times the character test, the integrity test that Joseph did. Are you willing to be patient? Joseph sat in prison for close to another 2 years after the cupbearer and the baker left. He could easily have said, "That's it. I've had enough. I've put up with this for the last time." But he didn't. He stayed true to his God. Faith, patience, character. I ask again, are you willing to wait for God?
Thank you for listening to the audio of Soma Community Church located in Jefferson City. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for the content or alter it in any way without express written permission. For more information about Soma, please visit us at www.somajc.org.